came back to see how he was doing. And in my mind, he looked worse. He was more somnolent. So I went to listen to his lungs and they sounded quiet, like the wheezing had resolved. And this confused me because I expected it to get worse since the kiddo kind of looked worse. I went and grabbed the respiratory therapist because I was just questioning my own judgment, questioning what I heard. Like, was my stethoscope broken? Why couldn't I hear very much right now? So I had him listen and he started hustling. He told me, go grab the doctor ASAP. The kiddo was sicker. And yes, his wheezing had stopped because he was no longer moving much air. And his somnolence was from hypercapnia.
Hey there, I'm your host, Sarah Lorenzini, a rapid response nurse and educator who loves telling stories to teach critical thinking. This podcast is for nurses who want the knowledge, skills, and confidence to respond to any emergency. With almost 20 years of experience in the ER and critical care nursing and a master's degree in nursing education, I have a lot of stories to share, and I love to nerd out and break down the pathophysiology, pharmacology, and nurses' role in emergencies. Stories bring learning to life. It is way easier to learn from and remember the stories that my colleagues and mentors have told me than anything I've read in a textbook. And that is why I made this podcast. Every episode is packed full of exactly what you need to know to handle whatever crisis that could arise on your shift. It's one thing to get the right answer on the test, but knowing how to detect when your patient is declining and what to do when your patient is crashing is what will make or break your day and might just save your patient's life.
Welcome back to the Rapid Response Run podcast. This week is part two of a series on caring for the crashing asthmatic. In part one, I interviewed Brooklyn, an ER nurse who cared for what I would consider a nightmare case. Her patient was young and otherwise healthy, but had pretty severe asthma. And no matter what her and her team did to try and turn him around and take control of his asthma exacerbation, let me tell you, they literally used all the tools in the asthma toolkit, but he just continued to crash. So if you haven't listened to episode 96, you should just pause this one, go back and check it out first. It's a great example of how patients like this go from talking and, quote, stable to crashing and coding and ending up with some of the major complications of status asthmaticus. It's also really inspiring to hear the story unfold through Brooklyn's eyes as she just kept encountering obstacle after obstacle and complication after complication, and she just kept fighting for her patient. In her words, she's just glad they both survived the shift, her and the patient. But if you have already listened to episode 96, this week I hope to explain what exactly is happening physiologically that sometimes impairs patients from improving from our traditional treatment regimen, and then break down all the treatment options from first line to the last ditch effort interventions for the crashing asthmatic. So let's start with the pathophys. So asthma is a chronic inflammatory disorder characterized by narrowing of the airways, causing airflow obstruction. So not only is it difficult to get the air in, but more importantly, air can't get out. And the alveoli become hyperinflated as air gets trapped in the little air pockets and causes hypercapnia as the CO2 can't get out of the body. So long term, this can cause some structural changes of the airways, which only worsens the symptoms and severity of asthma exacerbations with time. So to be clear, with asthmatics, we don't just need to give them more oxygen. We need to open their airways so they can get CO2 out. So how do these patients look? Well, the clinical signs of someone having an asthma exacerbation are first and foremost tachypnea, and often tachycardia goes along with that. So you'll see an increased respiratory rate, usually greater than 30, increased work of breathing, they're using all their accessory muscles. They often can't speak in full sentences because they're so short of breath. Often they'll get in that tripod position to help kind of open things up a little bit. They're going to be wheezing, but not always. We'll talk about that. Their lungs might sound tight. Sometimes they're hypoxic, but sometimes they're not. So don't wait on hypoxia to be concerned. They'll often very anxious, right? And I would be too. If the anxiety turns into somnolence, you should be very worried. If they become diaphoretic, again, very concerning sign. They typically present with tachycardia, but if you have a bradycardic asthma exacerbation, something's up, grab the crash cart. All right, so in a perfect world, we would give bronchodilators and the airways open up and the patient can effectively exchange the gases. Yay! But the patients I want to talk about today and the one that Brooklyn cared for, they get on this asthma spiral of death. So let me break it down. It starts with they feel like they can't breathe. We call that dyspnea. And then because they can't breathe, well, they get anxiety, wouldn't you? And because they're anxious, well, now they start having tachypnea. So that's where they're breathing very fast. And so now because they're breathing so fast, there's not enough expiratory time, like when they're breathing out, to get the CO2 out. So then they start getting what we call auto-PEEP. PEEP is positive end expiratory pressure. It's an acronym. Auto-PEEP, meaning they're doing it to themselves. So basically, it gets to where they're taking more breaths in than they have space for inside their lungs. So they breathe in, but they don't have enough time to blow it out, and the lungs get very hyperinflated. So that hyperinflated lung causes the diaphragm to get kind of flat. And we rely on the diaphragm to move up and down to help kind of suck air in. So a flat diaphragm makes it even harder to breathe. And you know, whenever it's harder to breathe, then you breathe faster. And when you breathe faster, you can't get the CO2 out. And like, it's just a terrible spiral. So now that you know what they look like, let me just run through the treatment for these patients really quick, and then I'll break down each part in more detail. Okay, so the goal is oxygen in and CO2 out. So we have to attack the bronchoconstriction problem from multiple angles, not just with bronchodilators. We also want to reduce inflammation to slow their respiratory rate. So some of the mainstay interventions that we do for other respiratory illnesses don't really apply as much to this patient population. For example, your goal is not to get a perfect CO2. So for asthmatics, you actually allow for a little bit of hypercapnia. We kind of expect that. We're not trying to, quote, blow off all the CO2 by increasing the respiratory rate. In fact, we actually want to decrease the respiratory rate and allow for more expiratory time so they can get the CO2 out. This feels a little bit backwards from what we're used to thinking about because we often have to increase respiratory rate to blow off CO2, right? Think about every other hypercapnic respiratory failure patient. Your oversedated patients, often your COPD patients, your sleep apnea patients, you got to get them to take more breaths to get the CO2 out. But this patient population is different. High respiratory rates are how the body's trying to compensate, but it ends up harming the patient in the end when they start breath stacking and taking in more breaths than they have space for in their lungs. So how we can help is by slowing their rate so they can effectively get the CO2 out. Interventions to reduce anxiety are just as valuable as bronchodilators. Like, we have to stop the spiral of tachypnea and anxiety and hyperinflation that cause cardiovascular collapse. I will even get eye to eye with the patient and try to coach them to take little inspirations and prolong their expiratory time. So like, take a breath in and then blow it out. We gotta get that CO2 out. We want to prioritize compliance with the non-invasive positive pressure ventilations or BiPAP. This is our patient's best chance. We would really like to try to avoid all the complications that go along with intubation. But you know, if you have to, there are ways we can intubate and ventilate safely and try to mitigate some of those risks. The last little nugget is something that I learned the hard way. Absent wheezing in asthmatics, we call it silent chest. Da-dun. It's not a good thing. This usually means the patient is moving less air and that they're worsening, not necessarily getting better. I remember when I was a new grad and I had this pediatric patient with asthma, super loud wheezing, in lots of distress. So I gave a couple of nebs and I came back to see how he was doing. And in my mind, he looked worse. He was more somnolent. So I went to listen to his lungs and they sounded quiet, like the wheezing had resolved. This confused me because I expected it to get worse since the kiddo kind of looked worse. I went and grabbed the respiratory therapist because I was just questioning my own judgment, questioning what I heard. Like, was my stethoscope broken? Why couldn't I hear very much right now? So I had him listen and he started hustling. He told me, go grab the doctor ASAP. The kiddo was sicker. And yes, his wheezing had stopped because he was no longer moving much air. And his somnolence was from hypercapnia. I will never forget that. And I hope you don't either. So let's go through our first line interventions and then all of the other adjunctive interventions when the first line just ain't cutting it. Okay, so first, beta-2 agonist. If you remember from my vasopressor episode, there are two types of beta agonist. Beta 1 affects the heart, and beta 1 is a positive inotrope and a positive chronotrope. So beta 1 makes the heart squeeze more effectively and squeeze faster. Beta 2s, however, affect the lungs as bronchodilators. So you can remember beta 1 because there's one heart and beta 2 because there's two lungs. So beta 1 affects the heart, beta 2 affects lung function. Beta 2s are bronchodilators like albuterol. Don't be afraid to give a ton of albuterol to these patients. Sometimes we'll even do continuous nebulizers. Like we just keep giving them until the airways open up and respond in the way that we're hoping. But there are other first-line treatments that go well with bronchodilators, like ipratropium. IV steroids also work well as anti-inflammatories and kind of calm down that inflammatory cascade going on that's just contributing to these tight airways. These are kind of the mainstays for asthma. But let's say that steroids and a Duo-Neb combo isn't cutting it. Patient's still working hard and getting tired. Here are the interventions that Brooklyn provided to her patient. Tributyline and epinephrine. So both of these are also beta 2 agonists and work as bronchodilators. Tributyline is administered sub-Q, and you can give it every 15 minutes until the desired effect is achieved, up to a total of 3 doses. Epinephrine is a both beta 1 and beta 2, but we're giving it mainly for the beta 2, right? So epinephrine is usually given IM, well, when you have the time to give it IM, right? Remember that IM epi has an onset of action of like 5 to 10 minutes. So if you don't think you have 5 to 10 minutes, then you need to give the epinephrine intravenously. You only give the full crash guard dose of epi, the whole 1 milligram, if your patient is pulseless. So for a crashing patient who still has a pulse, you can use what we call push dose epi. So that's when you mix up 1 mL of the 1 milligram per 10 mL epinephrine, and you mix that into 9 mL of saline. So we're really diluting it down. When you do that, you have a concentration of 10 micrograms per mL. So for a crashing asthmatic, you'd administer 1 microgram per kilogram. So for a 70 kilo patient, you're giving 7 mL or 70 mics. So if I just totally lost you with all those numbers, I will post a video on my Instagram of me mixing up push dose epi. Alternatively, you can also just start an epinephrine infusion and titrate to effect. But again, sometimes that also takes time to get that at the bedside, get the pump set up and everything. So do whatever seems best for your patient at the time, whatever the doctor feels comfortable administering. So takeaway here is sometimes albuterol is just not enough, and you have to pull out the big beta 2 guns, which is epinephrine. Brooklyn's patient also received magnesium. So magnesium is pretty well debated in the literature. There are older studies stating that it's a smooth muscle relaxer and it has properties that help with bronchodilation. But there's also several studies showing it does nothing at all. So I don't know. I have given it for sure, but usually in conjunction with other big guns. So it's really hard to say from personal experience if it seems to help or not. I'll let you determine that yourself. I put a few links in the show notes for you if you want to learn more. But if you do give magnesium, don't just push it straight undiluted like you do in a code. This will make your patient feel terrible. The recommended dose is 2 grams over 20 minutes. So not the little vial, but the mini bag that usually hang over an hour or two. Yes, I know your IV pump probably recommends a slower rate, but it is evidence-based. And the recommended administration rate by UpToDate and multiple other sources is the 2 grams over 20 minutes. So the next thing I want to discuss for this patient population is sedation. Hey guys, I'll get back to the episode in just a second, but I wanted to pause to let you know that if you love my podcast, but wish there were more of these awesome episodes, well, I have great news for you. There is more. My Rapid Response Academy is basically podcast 2.0. Plus the huge added bonus of community. I love hosting this podcast, but it's just me recording into a microphone often by myself. And this extroverted gal who loves to both teach and mentor nurses just wanted more. So in the community I created, I get to teach live every Friday and break down topics that I think every nurse needs to know. From deep dives into the pathophys of every emergency you can think of, to some of the heart of nursing topics as well, like how to advocate with confidence for your patient, how to de-escalate situations, how to deal with bullies on the unit, how to be an amazing preceptor and charge nurse, and some of the mindsets and boundaries that have helped me stay in nursing for the last 20 years, not burn out, and thrive at the bedside.
I love the opportunity to answer your questions live, and it's such a joy to see nurses supporting each other in this community. So if you're an acute care nurse that wants to expedite your growth as a nurse and invest in yourself so that you can provide the best care to your patients, you would love my Rapid Response Academy. So to learn more, I put a link in the show notes for you. Hope to see you there.
You're like, sedation? Don't we want them to breathe?
Yes, we do.
But we need them to slow it down a little bit. And sedation is a good way to do that. Brooks and her team literally tried all of the best drugs for sedation. They tried dexmedetomidine, which some people call Presidex. They tried benzodiazepines. They tried ketamine. And he was still tachypneic. The goal here is to chill him out enough to slow the respiratory rate so that they can exhale long enough to get the CO2 out. I love dexmedetomidine. It's an alpha-2 agonist. It helps calm the patient without suppressing the respiratory drive, but it doesn't work very quickly. So if you need to sedate someone quickly, I would give something else first, maybe like an analgesic, until the dex can take effect. But please don't bolus dexmedetomidine. I mean, I know you can. I know the pump has the option for you to bolus, but I have seen this go wrong so many times. Like patients who are tachycardic and hypertensive, just plummeting their heart rate and blood pressure from a dexmedetomidine bolus. Gosh, especially when everyone was on BiPAP from COVID, it felt like half the hospital had a dexmedetomidine infusion to promote compliance with the BiPAP. I would get so many rapid responses after a dexmedetomidine bolus where I was finally like, can we just please stop bolusing dexmedetomidine? Just because you can doesn't mean you should. It's just not worth the risk, in my opinion. So use something else to kind of buy you some time until the dex can kick in. My favorite is fentanyl, but use whatever your provider is comfortable with. So yes, dex is great. Another medication that I have seen work amazingly for asthmatics and COPDers is ketamine. Now, this is a drug that the ER folks are pretty comfortable with, but I have found the rest of the hospital, not so much. So ketamine works to help disassociate patients from reality and can really help stop the asthma, anxiety, tachypnea spiral. Not only does it calm the patient, but it also has some bronchodilatory properties. So you can give it as a bolus. Well, or should I say, the provider can give it as a bolus. In my state, at least, RNs cannot push ketamine. Only someone with MD, APRN, PA, or paramedic behind their name can push ketamine. So please refer to your local state guidelines regarding ketamine administration. I have a lot to say about ketamine. I love the drug. I should probably do a whole episode about it at some point. Okay, so we've talked about beta-2 agonist to bronchodilate. We discussed magnesium, how it could help, and the importance of sedation to slow the patient's breathing down. And the last thing to discuss is how to support their ventilation. BiPAP is ideal. You know when you get to breathing like 30 to 40 breaths a minute for a while, you get tired. And BiPAP can help take some of the workload of breathing off the tired asthmatic. We don't want them to tire out. It can't and won't do all the work like the ventilator would, but it sure does help. So do whatever you can to help the asthmatic be compliant with the BiPAP. Give a generous amount of sedation, but you can't give the big guns of sedation because we still need them to initiate their own breaths, and the BiPAP can just augment the breaths that they're already taking. But let's say you have to intubate. Let me play you the clip again from when Brooklyn and the team decided it was time to intubate her patient.
He's like, I can't do this. And I'm like, okay, like here, just at least put the OptiFlow on. Like you just need some sort of oxygen. And so as we're like switching over to this OptiFlow mask, his eyes just like go wide. And his mom is like, oh no, something changed. And he just goes into like severe respiratory distress. And the last thing he says is, give me the tube.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Like it was like this thing came over him and he realized how bad his breathing was. So I put the OptiFlow mask on him. We sit him in the bed. He's tripodding. He's breathing like 70 and he's desatting even on the OptiFlow now. Run back out, tell the doc like, hey, he totally decompensated. We're going to have to tube him now.
So yeah. If your asthmatic patient is asking for the ET tube and breathing 70 plus breaths a minute, you don't have much time before they code. It's time to take control of the airway, to intubate and heavily sedate so that you can stop the spiral towards the worst case scenario, which is circulatory collapse. So what are some of the signs or reasons why it's time to take the airway? Just like you saw with her patient, worsening work of breathing tachypnea despite multiple efforts to reduce the respiratory rate. If they're having a significantly worsened hypercapnia, so not just like it's 60, but like it's 160, we might want to intubate for that. The patient's having signs of impending arrest, like their pH is less than 7. They have that silent chest that I was talking about where they're not moving any air. If they become obtunded or bradycardic, yes, we're going to have to intubate. If their mental status is so severe that the patient has lost their ability to protect their airway, we probably have to intubate. So remember that intubating comes with its own set of risk. There are several things you want to do to mitigate this risk. So many things that I took a whole podcast episode to talk about them. Episode 73 of the podcast is called Resuscitate Before You Intubate, How Not to Kill Your Patient When You Intubate. So if you want to learn more how to do intubation well and the things that the nurse can do to set the patient and their team up for success, you definitely want to check out that episode. But even when you do all the things right, just like Brooke and her team did, there still can be some major complications of intubating. They had no issues getting the tube in. He tolerated that just fine. But it's not like you can just put an ET tube in and yay, now they're fixed. The ET tube itself does nothing for an asthmatic. It's not like it's anaphylaxis where the ET tube kind of stents open the airway that's closing from edema. The endotracheal tube is literally just that, a tube in the trachea. And the only benefit from the ET tube is that we can attach it to a ventilator and we can take control of the timing of and the amount of each breath that's delivered. But we still have the problem of tight airways and auto-PEEP that needs to be addressed aggressively. But now the patient can be sedated and even paralyzed to promote compliance with the ventilator. The other thing that Brooklyn and her team did is manually decompress the chest. Like they physically squeeze his chest to deflate those hyperinflated lungs. I mean, 70 breaths per minute. Yeah, that's a lot of breath stacking. And ultimately, despite their best efforts, the worst case scenario happened. He got a pneumothorax. So let's listen again to Brooklyn's description of the event.
All of a sudden, his blood pressure tanks. So we turn off the nicardipine drip. And the doctors are coming in the room and we were planning to put these chest tubes in. So they're at bedside setting up with chest tubes. And then doc's like, go get a Levofed drip because his pressure is tanking. So I'm going to grab Levofed. We're pulling the crash cart close by and all of a sudden he arrests.
So her patient, who was hypertensive and tachycardic, suddenly plummeted his blood pressure and heart rate started to drop. So those are ominous signs. And the team knew exactly what was happening. All that hyperinflation had caused a pneumothorax, and his forward flow of blood was impeded by air filling up the wrong spaces. The patient went into cardiac arrest, but they immediately performed a needle decompression and placed chest tubes, and they quickly regained a pulse. The takeaway here is, if your super sick asthmatic suddenly decompensates hemodynamically, check for a pneumo. After placing bilateral chest tubes and getting a pulse back, Brooklyn's patient was transferred for VV ECMO, meaning they had to place two large catheters in her patient and connect him to an external machine that could do the work of the lungs to both put oxygen in the blood and remove CO2 from the blood. For this patient, it was his only hope for survival because his lungs were so hyperinflated, they needed to recover. But with time, the bronchodilators finally kicked in and he was able to be weaned off the ECMO and his lungs were able to resume their role of exchanging the gases. Yes. Okay. This is getting really long. I still have more I want to talk about, but I think I may need to save it for another episode. I want to do an episode on end-tidal CO2 monitoring. It's like my favorite thing to talk about. I want to talk about Heliox a bit more and I'd love to talk more about pneumomediastinum and pneumothorax. So more to come on those. But I think we've covered enough for now so that you could confidently approach a crashing asthmatic and know what to look for and know how to tell when things are going south and what treatment interventions to anticipate. So to review, with your crashing asthmatic, we need to stop the dyspnea, tachypnea, auto-PEEP, hyperinflation spiral, which leads to hypercapnia and hypoxia. So our approach to this is three-pronged. First, bronchodilate with bronchodilators like albuterol or big guns like epinephrine. Steroids can help reduce inflammation and magnesium may help support bronchodilation. Secondly, you have to slow down the respiratory rate. to allow for the CO2 to get out. Give anxiolytics, sedation, analgesics. Some great options are ketamine, dexmedetomidine, maybe benzodiazepines, especially if they already take benzos at home. And pain medications like fentanyl can help calm your patient and reduce the respiratory rate to help break that spiral. And finally, we need to support their oxygenation and ventilation with supplemental oxygen and maybe positive pressure. If it looks like the patient's not going to be able to continue breathing on their own, intubation allows the medical team to heavily sedate the patient and take control of the respiratory rate. Both the amount of time that they take to inhale and exhale, as well as safe amounts of volume and pressure that we can deliver to these hyperinflated lungs. So, bronchodilate, slow the respiratory rate, and support oxygenation and ventilation. The last thing I want to leave you with is just a reminder of how important your role as the nurse is. Not only are you the one who's administering many of these medications to the patient, but you also have the ability to set the tone in the room. Remember that anxiety is a part of this spiral. And if we can't slow the patient's respiratory rate, they will continue to decline. I can't stress enough how important a calm and firm bedside manner is. That being said, I call this a nightmare case for a reason. It is scary when you're trying everything you can to turn your patient around and they keep crashing. But now you know what your options are. Now you know what to look for to determine if they aren't improving, and you know how to advocate for your patient. So use your eyes, your ears, your stethoscope, and your intuition to guide you when you sense your patient's not improving. And open up your toolbox of interventions for the crashing asthmatic, because you've got this. Before you go, I just wanted to let you know that if you like this episode, you would probably like my course too. My 1-hour rapid response and rescue course is an introduction to how I approach emergencies. If you would like to learn to think, assess, and respond quickly when your patient is crashing, then you can check out my website, rapidresponseandrescue.com. And if you message me the word podcast on Instagram, I will send you a coupon code for $10 off the cost of the course. Oh, and did I mention that the course is approved by the AACN and worth one continuing education contact hour? So if you want to level up your emergency response skills and get one CE in the process, then this course is what you want. I put the link in the show notes for you. Well, thanks for listening. I hope you learned something that will save a life. Remember, nursing is a team sport, so trust your intuition and don't give up advocating until you are confident you've done what's right by your patient. The views and opinions expressed on this show are that of Sarah Lorenzini and hers alone. They are not intended as medical advice and should not take the place of your institution's policies or procedures. Evidence-based practice is ever-changing, and your patient care should reflect the current best practice. If you want to get in contact with Sarah, you can find her at rapidresponseandrescue.com or on social media platforms as The Rapid Response RN.